The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With Nissan Subscribe and Drive. No deposit, no compromise, no fuss. Find out more at nissan.ie.
I am joined on the show by Alistair Campbell, known to many of you, of course, as the former Director of Communications and Strategy under Tony Blair. He's also the author of the Alistair Campbell Diaries. He's up to Volume 8, The Rise and Fall of the Olympic Spirit. Alistair, a pleasure to speak to you here on the show. We appreciate your time. I mean, you must be running out of diaries to flog at this stage.
Well, I'm up to 2015, but I mean, Tony Benn kept doing them till he dropped dead, so don't see why I shouldn't.
So that's the plan. Keep going until you drop dead. I mean, 2010 to 2015, the latest edition. The country, your country, at something of a crossroads in 2010.
Yeah, it really was. And I, you know, we're out of power. David Cameron comes in with the coalition. This is the period when we had the Scottish referendum, where I think that issue really exploded into a central place within the UK political debate. We also had David Cameron, stupidly in my view, deciding that the only way he could deal with his divisions in the Tory party on Europe was to call a referendum. We all know the disaster that that's turned out to be. The reason I called it The Rise and Fall of the Olympic Spirit, for me, 2012, London 2012 was one of the best times to be alive if you were British and living in London as I do. And I just feel that's gone. I feel that sort of sense of positivity, the sense of social and cohesion, if you like, that was there for that period of the Olympics and the Paralympics. I just feel it's gone. And I do think actually a decade of Tories and the austerity program, now Brexit and Johnson and COVID, I just feel we're a very different sort of country, and I can't pretend that I like it very much.
In 2010, had we spoken, some of the root causes for people to, you know, turn their back, to this desire to turn their back on the European Union, would have been there. Were you aware of them at that time?
Yeah, I think we're aware that there was never a great love for the European Union in the way that, say, there is a love of Irish people for Ireland, or a love for British people for the UK, and I think that's the same across Europe. I mean, people tend not to love institutions. They tend to love people with whom they can identify. And then over time, I think you can have a sense of belonging. And that's why flags and symbols are so important. But the fact is that until Cameron decided to have the referendum, there was very little demand outside a pretty zealous bunch of, you know, Farage people and the right wing of the Conservative Party. And Europe was very, very low down. And actually, I think there are now, as a result of Brexit, I think, funnily enough, it was a European leader, European politician, who said that Britain has now probably got the biggest network of passionately pro-European Union people of any country in Europe. But it's just that we have no voice, because the government is now just a Brexit government. That's all it is. And the Labour Party has decided to, you know, to back the Brexit deal and to try to just ignore the issue, which is, I think, on both sides, a disastrous pair of decisions.
You mentioned Ireland there and Northern Ireland. Ireland features in the latest edition of the Diaries, Volume 8, with various trips over and back, including the royal visit, the Queen's visit here, which took place. You write in the Diaries, though, about Tony Blair and Tony Blair's place in history and his legacy in terms of the peace process, and your frustration at how he's been written out of it. Is that fair?
Yes, it is. I thought that was obviously an incredibly significant moment in the history and the development of relations between Ireland and the UK. The Queen, if you think about, you know, the death of Mountbatten, and the Queen had never visited for obvious reasons, and she goes there, and I just felt that there was no sense of that kind of historical context. And I think that, okay, we were out of power and David Cameron was Prime Minister, but I'm trying to think what an equivalent might have been. But I've got no doubt whatsoever that if a Labour government had been in power at a time something like that was happened and say, you know, John Major, for example, Tony Blair was always, I think, although he and John Major fought very tough campaigns against each other in 1997, Tony Blair would always make a point of emphasizing that John Major played such a significant role in laying the ground. And I did feel that Tony was to some extent written out of that piece of history. And I think that was a mistake. And of course, I also say in this book, it came at the time when, in the same period when Prince William was marrying Kate Middleton, and it seemed again very odd to me that Conservative politicians and former Prime Minister John Major were invited to the wedding and Tony Blair and Gordon Brown weren't. I just think these things are, they're just odd. And I think it makes me feel that, you know, I can see this now with Keir, I saw it with Ed Miliband in this period that we're talking about. It's much, much harder for Labour leaders to kind of to be accepted as, if you like, legitimate political figures.
You mentioned marriage there. We should talk about some good news. You're not married. You haven't got married, should I say, but you have tied the knot. Can you explain?
We've decided after 41 and a half years that it's time that we signed a little piece of paper. And the thing is that Fiona, my partner, she was always against marriage because she's basically a feminist. I've never been big on marriage because I'm an atheist. I don't do God. And I've always seen marriage as a religious thing. I think it's two people marrying, if you like, in the eyes of God. And that's what marriage has always kind of seemed to mean to me. I could be wrong about that, but that's how I see it. So we've never been keen on marriage. Fiona was my partner was a very big part of the campaign to get equality for unmarried or heterosexual couples, because you had a situation with the change of legislation meant that gay couples could choose between marriage, civil partnership, or just living together. Whereas heterosexual couples don't have those choices or didn't have those choices. So she campaigned with others to change the law. The law got changed, and then we decided to do the deed, which we did with our three children and one partner on Tuesday.
Well, congratulations. How is unmarried life?
it's just the same as it's just the same as pre-Tuesday unmarried life.
All right. Okay. I've
got a terrible confession to make. It was quite a hot day, and I'd been out swimming at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd also been out doing a bit of work, and I added to which we had a little do in the garden. And I was a bit tired, so I was actually fast asleep by 9:30 before Fiona had even got upstairs. So I can't pretend it was the most passionately romantic night of my life.
It comes the civil partnership, I suppose, comes beyond 2015, obviously. So it's not featured in the diaries. The diaries aren't all just accounts of stories that were in the public eye, though there are personal stories in there, as there have been in previous editions of your diaries. And you're right, quite poignantly in this one, about your son and his battles with alcoholism.
Yeah, and that was difficult. Not difficult to write. It was difficult to live through, and it's hard. I think any parent who's been through seeing their child fall, into addiction, is very, 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 very difficult. And of course, I had lots of people saying to me, "Oh, well, at least you went through something similar around the same age. You're bound to be able to help a lot more than maybe others could." But I found actually I couldn't. I found the sense of helplessness much, much worse for going through it with Callum than I did for myself. Because of course, when you're the addict, as it were, when you're the person descending into alcoholism, you give yourself reasons why it's okay. You kind of, and it's every else who's got the problem. And the truth is, what I've seen, having seen it with Callum, is this utter sense of helplessness. You feel you ought to be able to do something to help. You feel you ought to be able to guide him in a different direction, but you can't. And funny enough, because I've been for some years now seeing a psychiatrist myself for my depression, he was very, very helpful in terms of actually stealing me, to be honest, to do the tough love thing. And that is a very, very hard thing to do. But, I describe in the book the time when Callum, we had an agreement that he could continue to live with us. We'd continue to, look after him in terms of eating food and shelter and financial support and all that stuff. But we said to him, if you come home drunk, you're not coming in the house. And of course, we'd said that loads of times before, and we'd never done it. We'd always, in the end, relented. And this one night, middle of the winter, when I actually just said, no, sorry, you're not coming in. And I shut the door and I just collapsed in a heap at what I'd done, and spent the whole night then, the pair of us, Fiona and I, just lying awake at night, wondering if he'd be, you know, fall in a canal, get hit by a bus. You just don't know what's happening. But I think it may have been the right thing to do. And then eventually, you know, he came to the realization that he had to have help. We'd actually been to Ireland to a place called Torrenfield, which is now closed down, but he went for rehab in Ireland. We thought, you know, get him out of the country, get him somewhere else, new environment. And the place was great. It really was good, but it didn't work. And that's sometimes the case. He came out and he was drinking the first night he came back. And eventually he came to us and said, look, I think I do need to go somewhere. And we found him a different place up in Scotland. And touch wood, that was 8 years ago, and he hasn't had a drink since.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how is he today?
Yeah, he's good. I mean, it's, you know, I think there's always, I think for, you know, it's like me when I had a drink problem and then I stopped drinking. I didn't touch it for 13 years. And, you know, yeah, what I've learned and I've learned to deal with is that there were other issues going on, which for me come out in my depression and sometimes in anxiety and, you know, workaholism. And I'm an addict. I'm addicted to work. I'm addicted to music. I'm addicted to sport. I'm addicted to my football team. I'm addicted to my bagpipes. I mean, these are kind of healthier in a way, but it's that straining your personality, which is still there. So he's got a good job. He's very, very good at it. But, you know, I think we're always just, you're mindful of the fact that there's always something in there that, you know, you've got to be wary. You've got to watch out for it.
Yeah, listen, it's good to hear at least that, look, he turned a corner all those years ago and he's doing well today. The diaries, as always, really interesting read for anybody who's got an interest in the recent histories of not just your island, of these islands and of the relationship as well with Europe. Alistair, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you, Ciarán. All the best.